Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we will be featuring Wendy Gunn, and she'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the Colorado River at Lee's Ferry. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Wendy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show as possible tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of the broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Wendy about fly fishing the Colorado River at Lee's Ferry. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout and Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and helped with the Striped Bass Game Fish 2006 Symposium in Foxborough, Massachusetts last year, just to name a few. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of the fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give back something to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Wendy, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year membership to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet, just go to our homepage and look for the link under Wendy's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. Well, tonight our guest is Wendy Gunn. It is unlikely that any woman in history has ever caught more fish, larger fish, or more diverse fish than Wendy Gunn. She has set and still holds IGFA world records for the size of her catch. She was the first woman to land a striped marlin on the fly and in a fly casting distance competition, twice exceeding 100 feet with 5-weight line. Gunn's travels to achieve fly fishing pinnacles look like a page from National Geographic. Australia for black marlin, New Guinea for black bass, Saratoga or Spotted Barramundi and black marlin. Belize for bonefish, permit, and tarpon, including 2 grand slams, consisting of all 3 species in 1 day. Costa Rica for tarpon, Mexico for marlin, wahoo, roosterfish, dorado, yellowfin tuna, and Pacific cubera snapper. Florida for trout, for tarpon and for permit. And Alaska for rainbow trout, all 5 salmon species, grayling, and northern pike. That's a lot of fish, Wendy. Wow. Wendy, with her husband, Terry, owns Lee's Ferry Anglers and Cliff Dwellers Lodge in Marble Canyon, Arizona, where she's general manager of operations. Lee's Ferry Anglers is one of the largest fly fishing outfitters in the world, employing 14 full-time guides. Cliff Dwellers Lodge is a year-round lodge located at the base of a 294,000-acre Vermilion Cliffs National Monument on the road that connects north and south rims of the Grand Canyon. In addition to cover photos on virtually every fly fishing magazine, Wendy has been featured on television as the series host of Fishing the West, America's Outdoor Journal, and Fly Fishing TV Magazine, which is aired on Fox, OLN, and the Outdoor Channel. Her 2 fly fishing videos are An Introduction to Fly Fishing and An Introduction to Fly Casting. An ardent conservationist, she's active in Trout Unlimited and other groups, as well as Casting for Recovery, an organization that helps women recover from breast cancer. Wendy, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you, Roger. I'm happy to be here.
Well, that was a rather long introduction, wasn't it?
It made it sound like I'd been everywhere.
Well, you've done a few things, it sounds like, which is really great, because you must have just a ton of information to share with us tonight, which is what we're all waiting for. So I think we'll have a lot of fun with that. What we're going to do, folks out there, is we've got a lot of questions, of course, as usual. And we're kind of going to give you a picture of the Lee's Ferry area, which is the Colorado River, just at the entrance to the Grand Canyon. And a wonderful, wonderful place. We'll talk about it as an environment, it as a fishery. We'll talk about Wendy's specifics on how she fishes it, guides it, what equipment she uses, flies she uses, techniques, strategies. We'll also talk about trips and accommodations down there so you know what you're in for when you go down there and what to expect, when to go. We'll also hope to talk, if we have enough time, a few things about specifically about women in fly fishing that Wendy might be able to talk to directly. So with that in mind, we'll get going here, Wendy. Let's just start out talking about you a little bit. How did you get into fly fishing and guiding and running this whole thing down there in Lee's Ferry?
Well, Lee's Ferry is very remote, so it was quite by accident that I ended up there. But I grew up fishing and doing things outside, and I had seen somebody fly fish when I was about 13 or so, and thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. I remember the brown waders and the green line in the air and thought it just touched my heart, and I guess it never left. When I moved down to Arizona, I was actually traveling around thinking that I would like to hike the Grand Canyon and maybe do some whitewater rafting, and there was fishing there also, so, you know, I like to fish, what the heck. Got down there and met my husband, who's been guiding there now for, 25 years or so, Terry. And he was a guide. We became friends, and I asked him if he fly fished. And he said yes, and I asked him if he would teach me. And that was, 21, 22 years ago. And just never left. Ended up staying, loved teaching it. It's the great thing about fly fishing is, it's art, it's finesse. It's something that men and women can do together. It's not a power sport, so, we tend to do it pretty well. I fell in love with it and, never left. And, one of the great things is you never quit learning. Fly fishing, you never know it all. You may think you do, and then you find out you don't.
Takes one more day on the river to figure that out, doesn't it?
Exactly. You think you got it all figured out, and then all of a sudden you realize, I really don't have this figured out. So, it's a great sport, and that's how I ended up there, and it was just my love for it and my passion for it. Like Terry said, when he first taught me how, he says, the first thing you have to learn is you have to learn to cast, because the first thing you have to do is be able to get the fly to the fish. And so he went out of town, and he told me to practice, 20 minutes a week or so. Well, I kind of practiced 20 to 45 minutes a day. He got back, and I was like, come on, let's go cast. And he watched me and just went, wow, how much did you do it? And I said, well, I've always done sports well, so I'm going to practice and be good. But, it comes in steps with fly fishing. You got to learn to get the fly to the fish first. Then you got to make the fly do the right thing. And then you have to learn to hook and land them.
That's right. Well, I'll tell you, I've never heard a pickup line like that one. That's one way to get a man. Teach me how to fish.
Yeah, well, he tells everybody that I did not use barbless or catch and release.
Oh, you did? I guess not after 20 years. Well, you got him, that's for sure, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing, because I was down at Lee's Ferry a year ago, April, because we did a trip, 21-day trip down the Grand Canyon, a private trip that a group of us friends did, and it is really out of the way, to
well,
say the least.
There's a population of, probably 70 people within about 20 miles. So, it's, a very remote chance that we met there and ended up staying, and the rest is history. We did that, and then we weren't there long, and we started a fly shop, and then ended up hiring more guides, and then evolved into buying a lodge in 2001. So now we have, a restaurant and a lodge, and the whole gamut. So it's been quite the adventure.
Well, it sounds like you really have your hands full down there and have quite the business going. That's great. That's great. Now you've based upon our introduction, it sounds like you fished all over the world. Where's your favorite place besides Lee's Ferry and a favorite fish?
Boy, you know, favorite places, I can't really narrow that down to just one place.
Okay.
I mean, I've been blessed to be many places. I mean, there's nothing like Alaska and the Kwajak River fishing for 20-pound rainbows. There's something about being out on the ocean and teasing up marlin and getting sight casting to those guys. My biggest pleasure with fly fishing is going places where you get to be visual, where you get to sight cast to fish. It can be a lot more frustrating because you can't, you know, you're seeing them and can't get them to eat. But to me, there's nothing more satisfying than seeing a fish, watching what they're doing, making a specific cast to a fish, and getting them to eat, and hooking them and landing them. That, I think, is my favorite, because there's so much other things. I mean, I went to Papua New Guinea for black bass, and it was cold, and the water temperature was cold, and, you know, we had six boats out every day on the Irrawaddy River, and we had some really good fishermen, and I think we caught one barramundi out of 10 days. But we did some great birding, so, I mean, there was other things to do, but the sight casting, I think, for fishing, for me, is everything, whether it's permit, bonefish, you know, marlin, you know, tarpon. I mean, watching a tarpon come down the pike, you know, down in Florida.
That's exciting.
You know? Yeah. I mean, it's really hard when they're 300 yards away not to start casting, you know, even though it's worthless, but you get so excited seeing them come.
Yeah, you sure do. Well, what's the most unusual fish you've caught on a fly? Let's put it that way.
Oh, unusual. Well, let's see. I've caught some catfish on a fly in New Guinea.
Yeah,
caught some catfish in New Guinea, dredging the bottom. Let's see, what else have I caught? Well, you know, catching some needlefish and strange things like that in Mexico, surely by accident. Just some different types of stuff, you know. And then, of course, piranha, you know, down in Argentina. So that was kind of interesting, catching piranha.
Yeah, I bet.
And the other thing, you know, in shark fishing. I found shark fishing off of San Diego, fishing for makos. So that's... I never wanted to fish for something that could eat me, and I did. It's pretty intense.
Yeah. We did a show with Conway Bowman on fishing for makos down there.
It's
quite interesting.
Yeah, they're fun to watch, and they're like a tarpon when you hook into them. I mean, they'll tail walk, jump, run, and, I mean, rip line. They're pretty fun.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to Lee's Ferry. Tell the folks that don't know, because we've got listeners usually from all over the world, where Lee's Ferry is in the Colorado River, at Lee's Ferry, and how do you get there?
Sure. Well, Lee's Ferry is in extreme northern Arizona. It is actually the tailwater rainbow trout fishery down below Lake Powell and the Glen Canyon Dam. And as I said, it's very remote. To get there, the closest town to us is Page, Arizona, which is only a population of about 9,000. And Page, Arizona is there because of Lake Powell. The closest airports for a mid-sized college-type towns would be Flagstaff, Arizona, or St. George, Utah. The biggest, the larger towns would be about 260 miles away. We're kind of split right in the middle between Las Vegas and Phoenix. And there are the commuter flights, of course, that get up into Flagstaff or up into Page. Or you can rent a car. Basically, it's about a four-hour drive from either one. Pretty easy drive, freeway half of it, and then two-lane highway the other half. And, of course, there's lots of things to see from either direction, depending on the time of year. I mean, we are around a lot of national parks, Zion, Bryce, the Grand Canyon, all of that. And then there's dinosaur tracks and things like that to do and see on the way up also.
Yeah, there is that's really an incredible part of the country. That and southern Utah, just north of you.
Exactly.
Those parks are a good place to spend a month, right?
Yeah.
It's got that much to see, at least.
Yeah, well, and then Lee's Ferry, the history of Lee's Ferry is huge. You know, that's John Doyle Lee built the crossing that was the only place to cross the Colorado River to get from Arizona into Utah. And that's, you know, for the honeymoon trail for the Mormons to come across. That's what Lee's Ferry was a ferry crossing going across. And you can still see where there's a steam engine in the water. They maintain some of the old outbuildings. They maintain the orchard. They maintain, you know, the old ranch houses and stuff back there, too. So there's a lot of history in that area, you know, all around us also.
And that you can still see the old road coming down there to the water, mm-hmm. I think, on the far side.
Yeah. And then there's inscriptions on the rocks, you know, from them traveling, you know, from people traveling. They'll have their last names and the dates, you know, from people traveling and everything. And those are along by the old outtake on the other side of the river, you know, so that's there, too. And then, you know, Lee's Ferry, of course, now is fishing. From there up to Lee's Ferry is actually the entrance point of the Grand Canyon and the end of the Glen Canyon. And if you go from Lee's Ferry down, as you did a year ago, you're going whitewater rafting through the Grand Canyon. And so you have 280-some miles before the outtake.
Right.
And then if you go from there upriver, you're in 15.5 miles of tailwater rainbow trout fishing.
You really have to go down there to appreciate that that is the only crossing because you drive around there, and these are steep canyons. I mean, when we're talking the entrance to the Grand Canyon, when you push off there, that's it. I mean, it's a long ways before you get to Phantom Ranch, and somebody can hike in, and you can see somebody again. But there is no getting out of there. And likewise, now going up, when we go up towards, when was the Glen Canyon Dam built, first of all?
Well, they started construction in 1957, and it was completed in 1963.
Okay.
And it was all done for, you know, the number one was water storage, recreation, and power. And so it is a power generation dam, you know, so we always have higher flows in the summer and the winter because that's when the most power is being sold.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, the dam was basically completed, and what happened, it was an undiscovered fishery until the early 70s, and in 1964 is when they started putting things in, because they took a muddy river, because it was muddy before coming through, and you know, they made it totally clear, crystal clear, you know, water, and so they threw some stuff in there. There's no real records of what they put in for the first, I believe, 10 years. And nobody really fished the river, so here you had this nutrient-rich system that had these rainbow trout and stuff put in, that just sat there and grew. And you talk to some people who fished it early 70s, not a lot, but early 70s. And then towards the end of the 70s was when the Arizona Game and Fish Department came in and declared it a blue ribbon trout fishery and took it from, it had a 10 fish limit from the early 70s on. I mean, literally, I've seen pictures of stringers of trout where it was 100 pounds of fish. Because, I mean, the trout there, they threw back the 8-pounders because they were considered small. They were all looking for those 10-plus pounders.
Those were the days.
Those were the days, exactly. And the largest fish that had ever been rumored to have been taken out was by somebody who had hiked in out of Page, a kid. And supposedly that fish was 22 pounds gutted. I've seen pictures of big fish, boy, from the old days there. So it was just a river that sat there and just, you know, it grew big fish.
So before the dam, it was the old Colorado, which is, too thick to drink and too thin to plow? Is that how they say
Exactly. Now, I'm sure that they fished for catfish,
right.
But that probably would have been just about it, you know, until the dam was built.
Right. So currently, what do you have in there? Rainbows?
It's pretty much all rain. Yeah, pretty much all rainbows. We see browns once in a while, but not. They're just not a common occurrence. When I first moved there, which was back in '85, there were brookies and cutthroat. But you know, with the native species, they didn't stock any of those ever again. They just kind of let those go away. And they actually haven't stocked the river now. And, oh, wow, it's been over 10 years, I guess. It's all been naturally reproduced, and it's all rainbows. But we do see browns once in a great while, just not a lot.
Well, Wendy, we need to take a break here, but when we come back, we'll talk more with Wendy about fishing the Colorado River. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. Again, that's 1-307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Wendy Gunn about fly fishing Colorado River at Lee's Ferry. If you'd like to ask Wendy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your questions. We'll receive your question, and immediately we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Wendy, before we get back to fishing there, tell us a bit about your operation, yours and Terry's operation down there, what you do in the way of services for fly fishers and so forth. So this is a time when you can shamelessly plug yourself.
Well, basically, Lee's Ferry Anglers is a full-service fly shop and guide service. We typically operate anywhere from 12 to 14 guides. We also own Cliff Dwellers Lodge, so, of course, our fishermen are put up there. And we have a restaurant and everything on site. We also provide, of course, you know, full gamut rental, waders, rods, the whole thing. Free. We're great about advice for people who come on their own, just want to know where to go, what to use. We have our little maps, you know, we'll diagram it out and, you know, tell people how to rig, where to go, what's been working. We've been in business since 1989. And we're really proud of the fact that, you know, we're honest with people. You know, you can call ahead of time. We'll let you know what's going on. You can go into our website. We have leesferry.com, where we do a river report. We try to do it every night, and update it and let people know we're honest about what's going on. I mean, hey, if it just hasn't been good, we're going to rate it that way. I mean, we rate the river and we're right up front there about what goes on, but we're open year round. We're open 362 days a year, I guess, closed Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and Thanksgiving, and that's it. And, we're always there to serve people. I mean, that's what fly shops are there for. We're there to get people into it and have them have a great trip, or at least give them the best shot possible at catching fish. And all of our guides are U.S. Coast Guard captains and Arizona State licensed also. We're operating, 20-foot Kofflers, which is a big welded aluminum boat with inboard jets, so they're heated in the wintertime and they have a cover in the summer so they can stay in the shade. It's all about the people. Typically a day on the water, it's, 8 to 9 hours out there, and my guides are great at instruction and teaching beginners, or if they just want to do some casting out in the parking lot with me during the day or whatever. I worked guiding for a while, and now I have 40-some employees, so I tend to be in the shop more than anything else. But I still do a lot of the lessons and things out of the shop.
Well, great. Why don't you give folks your website address and also your phone number there at the shop?
Sure. Well, for the Fly Shop and Guide Service, we are leesferry.com. So it's www.lees, and it's L-E-E-S, ferry.com, F-E-R-R-Y.com. We also have the website of cliffdwellerslodge.com, and there's a connection to both websites off of those, of course. There's links. And our phone number is 1-800-962-9755, and we are in there from 5:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night. Kind of unheard of for a fly shop, I know, but that's the hours we keep right now. And you can give us a call, and we can give you any up-to-date information. If you have questions, that's what we're there for.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks for educating us about your business. And I'm
sure
anyone going there will have to look you guys up.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah, got to come by.
Let's get back to the river there. How much water is there that's fishable then from, is it actually from the bottom of the dam down to the Lee's Ferry crossing, or is does the fishing fade off as it gets down to Lees? What all is fishable there?
No, I mean, you can fish that whole stretch, the whole 15 and a half miles. We can get to within about a quarter mile of the dam. They don't allow anybody to get right up there close to it, especially after 911. So, you know, you can get to within a certain point. We like to wade the river primarily and just use the boats for transportation. Now, depending on the water levels, like the higher water in the winter and the summertime, we'll drift out of the boats just because it allows us to get to the fish better. But we like to wade, and there's more wadeable water in the upper half of the river. You know, from like 7.5 mile up, there's more wading up in that stretch than there is down below, and we tend to fish more in that upper stretch just because the river is very large. We have holes upriver depth-wise that are 110 feet deep, and obviously, you know, we're not going to fly fish those holes. So there's a lot of really big channels and things. So we tend to pick the water apart in riffles, islands, things like that, that we get out and fish, and there's more of that upriver. There is down below what we call the walk wade area, and that's the only place that you can access without a powerboat, and it's about a half a mile stretch. It can fish very well, and it is where there's a little stream that comes in down below called the Paria, and the Paria can mud the whole river through the Grand Canyon when it flows. Like, it was flowing just the other day because we've had the monsoonal flow, so we've had rain, so the Paria's been flowing, so there's really not been any fishing down below that. But up above the Paria, that walk wade area is a beautiful stretch of river. I mean, you have pocket waters. You have the ledges, the riffles. I mean, it's just a beautiful stretch, and it can fish very well. Now, there is fishing down further than that if you want to hike into a couple of places. It's not always real good in those areas because people can use bait, and a lot of times they'll get in there and kind of clean them out. But you can get into a couple of areas down below that can fish pretty well if you're in, you know, if you're willing to adventure down some washes and hike in. So there is fishable water there, and then, you know, down through the Grand Canyon, you can hit some good fishing if the river's clear.
Yeah, if it's clear, yeah. I noticed when you're talking, maybe it was Paria, is that what you said?
The Paria.
When we were doing our raft trip, we were only, I think, at our first camp down river, which is, you know, maybe 10 miles down from you. And the water was just kind of this emerald green. It was beautiful water.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then within hours, we saw the whole river turn. And and it wasn't raining or anything. I mean, it was beautiful blue sky, and it all turned to mud within just hours. So
yeah,
was that
you
the Paria?
Yeah, that's the Paria. You couldn't see the black cloud that was back up on the Vermilion Cliffs up back behind in the Paria Wilderness area that probably it unleashed some rain and sent down the mud flow. And when the Paria flows, they say it can carry more sediment than any other stream in the United States.
I guess. I mean, we were just sitting on the you know, admiring the beautiful water, and this, it was almost like a Stephen King movie where, you know, this cloud and the water started down the center and then spread to the edges eventually. You know, it was, and you realize that's a lot of sediment that's got to be coming down in there. But
exactly, yeah, and yeah. It's all that red clay, so, you know, you get it just turns the whole river. But like I said, it can fish well down there if the river is clear. It just, you know, it just depends on when you're there, and it can clear up fast also.
Is that something you have to worry about when you're wading up, or is that Paria down below where you're wading?
Yeah, it's down below. It's
okay.
Down below the walk. We kind of consider the Paria is, you know, we tell everybody for the walk wade area, it's from the Paria, from the confluence of the Paria and the Colorado River up towards where the boat ramp is upriver. So you're wading that area up there. You typically don't have to worry about getting mudded out upriver unless we get a huge monsoonal storm in, which we did get about 2 weeks ago. This last Monday, we had a huge torrential rain hit, and it was very heavy, and it flowed some of the washes up above. And so it occurred in the afternoon, so it didn't affect us because we were already coming off the river. The day was done. But it did mud the river in the upper stretch, but it was clear by the morning. I mean, it doesn't last very long, but we can get, it's beautiful when it rains up there, though. You know, you go upriver, and we're inside of the Glen Canyon, what is the only part of the Glen Canyon that wasn't buried by Lake Powell. And so you go upriver, and you're inside of these canyon walls that are 1,500 feet higher than you. And it's all red sandstone. I mean, it's spectacular, beautiful. You know, the reflections. One of the problems we have is when people are fishing, it's like, quit looking around. You need to pay attention to the fishing,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
you know, how do you not open up your mouth and be awestruck at it?
And if you've been up on Lake Powell and seen what's above the waterline, and you've then been down below the dam, you can just imagine what's underwater. And I know a lot of people that were able to see that and float that before it was dammed up said
sure.
it's as good as, was as good as, if not better than the Grand Canyon itself. So
yes, that's what they've said, yeah.
That's quite a beautiful place to fish, that's for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, when we get those rains and stuff upriver, you get huge waterfalls and stuff. I mean, I've been at, you know, at 4 Mile, and you can look upriver at the bend at 5.5 or 6 miles, almost 2 miles upriver, and you can look and see the waterfalls coming off, and you're hardly getting any rain, but it's just coming down in tyrants up there. So you
right.
get in the boat, tell everybody to throw their rain gear on. Come on, it's worth seeing. You know,
yeah.
and go up
yeah.
and see it, because it doesn't happen very often, but it's beautiful.
Now, you said you use... did you say jet boats to get upriver?
Yeah, we use welded aluminum, like a 20-foot boat with 350, 351s. We use Kofflers,
Is there a way that you can use a drift boat on that section of the river?
There really is not, unless you can
okay.
find somebody who would tow you upriver or take the drift boat upriver.
Okay.
And the only way you can do that is to find a private individual who would do it, because I have people who call me and ask me all the time, or they want to bring belly boats and stuff like that. The problem is we're inside of the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. So we are permittees of the National Park Service, and we are permittees to guide fishermen only. So we're not allowed to do any kind of drop-off service or anything like that. And the thing is that if you are in a drift boat or something like that, you know, if you get into trouble up there, your only way out is by powerboat. You know, there's no way of getting up those cliffs. You're not getting out. So, and the water temperature stays 46 to 48 degrees year round. So you have to be very aware of what's going on. And so, no, there's no drift boats. There's a couple that comes up every so often, and she rows him up 8 miles. And bless her soul, I wouldn't do it for anything. But you know, they fish out of a drift boat, but and the gal rows it. And I mean, and they come up, you know, once or twice a year. But that's really about it. But there's no places to put in up above
right,
Lee's Ferry.
Right.
So you.
Well,
I've got a
question that came in on the internet that kind of pertains to the walk-in that you were talking about. Brian Charles in Aztec, New Mexico. Brian Charles Wagner, I should say, Aztec, New Mexico. Not too far from you.
No.
Wants to know what is your favorite walk-in spot?
That is. That stretch that I talked about, that walkwayed area, and I like it if he's familiar with that stretch. There's a big rock that is out in the middle of the river. By no means do I mean you can get out to where that rock is, but around by that big rock can be phenomenal fishing. And I also like the ledge down below right before the Paria comes in. There's a nice drop off, and you can get some really good fish that hang off that ledge.
Is that a hike in, or is that?
You know, the walkwayed area is on off of the main road going down to Lee's Ferry. There's a little pull out area that's like an old service road that's been cabled off, and then there's a big sign that says Gravel Bar, and there's trails that kind of beeline all over. They go all different directions. And I tell everybody to head more downstream, you know, and go out that way and fish out in there. But that is the best, you know, and like I said, unless you want to hike into one of the washes down below. But you have to make sure the Paria is not flowing, because if the river is not clear, it's not worth going in.
So the Paria is that river that enters the Colorado just below the camping area there at Lee's Ferry. Right?
Exactly. That
okay,
is the
I got the picture
mm-hmm.
now. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so yeah, that wouldn't affect any of the upriver things. So now up from the Lee's Ferry, is there any walk-in above there?
You know, the only place that you can follow the trail that goes up a little bit, and it goes up maybe about a mile, mile and a half, and fish. The biggest thing is that the boat traffic, you know, the fish will get, that area doesn't really have any riffles or anything to hold fish, so it would be more of what we would call your smaller fish that hold in the back eddies and things that are sipping on midges.
Mm-hmm.
And those fish tend to get put down by boat wakes, clouds, birds, So that it can be a little spooky, you know, a little tougher up there. There's not really any traditional fly fishing water up that area. You're better off down in the lower stretch in that walkweed area.
Okay, okay. We've got another question that came in on the Internet from Brian Whiting in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. He says, there's lots of places to catch trout. What do you feel is the most unique aspect of fishing at Lee's Ferry? There was some, and then in addition, there was some discussion at one time about additional gates to the dam at Lake Powell, so that water coming out would not be as cold.
Cold, yeah.
Which,
putting in
which would
tubes.
Seem to open the way for other hatches, such as caddis, mayfly, and other traditional insects. Is that so? That's the second question. Is that still in discussion, or is that a possibility?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the great things about Lee's Ferry is the diversity of the fishery. It's never the same. Because of power demand, with the different water flows and everything, it's a tough river to learn to fish, because it's always changing. From one day to the next, it can change. You know, different seasons because of water flows and stuff. I think it's technical. You can't always count on the same thing. It's always different, and that's because of water flows. I think that's one of the great things about Lee's Ferry. It's constantly evolving. I mean, when I first moved there in the mid '80s, it was, you know, big fish, you know, 3X, 4X, tippet, size 8 and 10, you know, scuds and, you know, big stuff. And then, you know, we've had to go smaller. And then it can change, like now we're using bigger stuff drifting out of a boat. And then we've had some phenomenal cicada fishing the last few summers. And it's just, it's never the same. Lee's Ferry is constantly evolving. And I think that's one of the great things about the fishery.
Go ahead. Talk about the water.
The warming trend. You know, that has been a discussion, and that is more, and that's not a consideration. They're not looking at doing this for trout. They're looking at doing this for the endangered species down below. You know, for the humpback chub and stuff, and because they do, you know, better in a warmer water situation, and that's why they're looking at putting in those warming tubes. So. Yeah, could we get more bugs? Sure. I mean, if we had a warming water, you bet we could get some hatches and stuff. Our only concern with the warming tubes is how warm are they going to get it?
Yeah.
You know, what are their limitations going to be, and where are they going to draw from on the lake? What's the level change? The one thing is that during the winter and stuff, the lake is cold. You know, it's 50-something degrees in the, you know, until the heat of summer. But in the summertime, that surface water temperature can get to 80-something degrees. So how warm, you know, where are they going to draw it from, and how warm are they going to make it? Could it add some greatness to our fishery? You bet. I mean, wouldn't we love to have some hatches? Because right now, our food base in our river are scuds, midges, and worms. And that is, and then cicadas and hoppers in the summertime. And, you know, that's it. So, I mean, wouldn't we love to maybe have a chance at some, you know, some stones or mayflies or, yeah, who wouldn't? But we would want to know exactly what they're going to do and what their limitations are going to be when they do it. But they are looking at it, yes.
Yeah, are the fluctuations of the dam releases, is that something that you need to worry about waiting if you're upriver?
You need to pay attention to it. It's not like it was in the old days. I mean, when we first started the shop in '89 and stuff, people would come in and you'd talk to them about fishing the walkweed area or going upriver. And the common rule then was you made two casts. And you took two steps back because you make a cast, and we use very long extended drifts. So, you know, you make a presentation, do the drift, bring it in and do another one. Then you take two steps back because the water would come up so high, so fast. The water has been regulated as far as how much they can change it and how quickly they can change it, but it still does change. So you need to be aware of that. You know, there's really no reason on our river to wade real deep, though, too. That's another thing.
Or across.
Yeah. I mean, we get people that think they got it. You know, just because you have a pair of waders on does not mean you have to stand up to your waist or higher. You know, typically, if you're standing that high, we're actually giggling at you because you're standing where the fish are.
Right.
You know, it's just you don't need to be that high. But you do need to be aware of it, that it is going to come up. And it does so more in the summer and the winter, you know, because those are the power demands. And I tell everybody, they go, well, when does it start coming up? And I said, figure about the time everybody in L.A. gets up and starts drying their hair. That's when the power demand goes up, and that's when you need to start paying attention. And, of course, down in that walk weight area, it happens later, you know, because the flows, it's got 16 miles to go before it starts raising. So, mm-hmm. you know, you just have to be pay attention, but it's not a huge thing like it used to be.
Okay, great, great. Well, we need to take another break here. So when we come back, we're going to talk more with you about the Colorado River, and more specifically, times of year. I'm getting a lot of questions in here about the time of year to go down there. So we'll start in on that when I get back. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net, or email them at Pudge, that's P-U-D-G-E, at womensflyfishing.net, or call them at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Wendy Gunn about fly fishing the Colorado River at Lee's Ferry. If you'd like to ask Wendy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show as possible tonight. And, folks, we always try to get to all the questions that come in. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes your question is answered by somebody else's question, so realize that we do pay attention and we do enjoy those questions coming in. Before we talk about time of year, though, a few questions we did have is about other attractions or other places to fish around there. You mentioned some washes or some streams downriver, but if you get out of Marble Canyon there and is there other places to fish in the area if you're going to spend a few weeks in the area?
Well, you know, we talked about, you mentioned southern Utah, which is, we think it's an undiscovered gem. There's a lot of fishing around southern Utah, Boulder Mountain, that area. There's Lake Powell. One of our guides actually owns Lake Powell Anglers, and they have, in the summertime, the spring, the right time of year, they have some phenomenal fly fishing for stripers and stuff up there. And everything that southern Utah, one of our guides up there around Escalante and Boulder Mountain. So there's a lot of stuff up there, the streams and then some lakes. But that's really about it. But, you know, if you wanted to combine it with another great tailwater fishery, too, is the San Juan. We're only about a five-hour drive to the San Juan River, too. So, you know, there are other opportunities, you know, around our area if you want to get out and get some remote, do the lake thing, or if you wanted to combine it with, you know, fishing another tailwater, you know, a great western tailwater.
Well, there's a vacation for you. You go to Lake Powell, you get yourself a houseboat, an outboard boat, and go fish for stripers, spend a week up there, then come down and see you folks and do some fishing on the river. Yeah.
And, you know, people ask me all the time, it's, you know, what else, you know, well, how, what's the optimum trip? You know, I tell everybody, I think 3 days is as long as you should spend at a river or someplace new to fish to see it. Really see the difference, you know, because, hey, it's fishing, and how many times did you get there? Should have been there yesterday or come back tomorrow.
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, and that is what it is. So, you know, 3 days, I think, you know, 2 days is good, 3 days is optimum. But,
yeah,
you know, there's so much to do, too. You know, some of the questions that we got is about ruins and petroglyphs,
right.
And there's a ton of that stuff out where we are. I mean, upriver, there's a huge wall, a petroglyph wall, and there's other sites, too. There's other places where you can walk around and find tons of pottery shards and stuff. And, you know, photography, I mean, where do you shoot first? You know, it's like the photography, the options out there to travel around. I mean, and You have Antelope Canyon, which is a beautiful slot canyon that's very close to us, that you can go up and do photography. And then just where we are, the photography around and upriver is just phenomenal. You know, it's a great place to do all of those kind of things. So you can combine it with other stuff.
Great, great. And one of the questions was, if you're doing these side hikes and so forth, are there any rattlers in the area you need to worry about?
You know, we do have rattlesnakes around, but they, you know, they're very rare. We see them on the river hardly. I've never seen one on the river, and I think Terry's only seen one. You know, we just, they don't want to see you as much as you don't want to see them. And,
yeah.
You know, they stay away. You know, you have to be aware of them, yes. But is it like there's a lot of them around? No.
No.
Just good. Be aware.
Okay, time of year. Now we've got three people that are asking this question in different ways. So,
sure.
Give me a second here, Wendy. It's Chuck Kaminsky wants to know if he gets a week's vacation, wants to use it to fish at Lee's Ferry. What time would be good to fish the river? Spring, fall, or winter? And then in what month? And now here's it asked a different way. Houston, Gibbs, and San Diego. Please list the order of the top 4 months that are best. And then Dave Yokovich in Southgate, Michigan would like to know, would September or October be better? So you're going to have to tell them what the best times of the year are, one way or the other here.
Okay, well, let's just go through. Times of the year is more of what kind of fishing they want to do. For us, the spring and the fall, both beautiful times of the year to be at Lee's Ferry. Cool mornings, warm days. With that, biggest crowds, most people. You know, it's typically, that is the time of year when you can get midge fishing, some dry fly fishing, lower water, so it's mostly all wading. Fishing a large attractor dry with a beadhead midge underneath. Sight casting more in the spring, two fish. You know, picking out specific fish in lower water, you know, and casting to them. The busiest times on the river, typically March, April, and May. And good fishing. You know, there's a reason for it. You know, those are great times. Starting about March 15th is when we start getting midges off, and that's usually when the bigger midges start coming, so that typically will turn the fish on. And we usually have the lower water in March, April, and May. June 1, the water comes up. We've had awesome, awesome summer fishing the last couple of years, the last about five. We have towards the end of June, the first couple of weeks of July, and it still was going on just a few days ago, we have cicada fishing. And that's, you know, it's hot, so you got to be able to take the heat, flat honest. I mean, our average high temperatures run 95 to 105 in the summer. Nighttime temperatures are 65 to 70. You know, but the water temperature stays the same. But we do more fishing out of the boat that time of year. You know, we're casting dries into shore, but watching fish come 10 feet away to hit a cicada, or doing heavy nymphing out of the boat with an indicator and a San Juan worm and a midge, or a scud and a midge. But the fish are fat and sassy in the summer, you know, very aggressive and jumping and not very many people. You know, the crowds are down. Fall time, same as the spring, busy time of year. You know, typically good fishing, you know, and busier time, more wading, and not as busy as the spring. So it's, you know, the winter time, you know, the Lee's Ferry used to be huge for winter fishing. That was the big draw, was because our fish spawned in the winter time. I mean, you sight casted the fish to big rainbow spawning in the winter. And it, you know, it was unusual, but our fish have moved more to a traditional spawn in the spring. So the winter time is clear and cold, and, you know, heavier nymphing and stuff for the fish. The fish look good. It can be good fishing, but it's not what it used to be, you know, as far as the sight casting to the spawning fish, because they've moved more towards the spring. But it's more of what people want to deal with, you know.
Yeah.
You know, as far as crowds and people and what kind of fishing they want to do, because I'll be honest with you, you know, I fish Belize in the summertime when it's hotter than Hades, you know. But the fishing can be so good, who cares? And,
yeah.
you know, as long as I have a cool place to sleep at night, I'm okay. And that's, you know, Lee's Ferry in the summertime. I mean, I have to tell you, that's been some just phenomenal fishing the last couple of years, and we just don't have the crowds. But you know,
the lodge
they,
does have air conditioning, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got to have air conditioning. But, and, you know, and to be honest with you, you know, if you're at the water surface level, you know, the water temperature is 48 degrees all the time, so you get a cooling effect.
Yeah,
from
yeah.
the water. But
yeah.
as soon as you take 10 steps away from the water's edge, I tell everybody it's the only place that you can get heat stroke from the waist up and hypothermia from the waist down, you know, because
yeah.
that's just the way Lee's Ferry is.
Yeah, my experience was there at the put-in at Lee's Ferry when we were getting our rafts ready, and I was barefoot. I could not stand in that water barefoot for more than a couple minutes, and my feet were aching. You know, it was
yeah.
really cold.
It's cold. It's cold.
Yeah.
yeah but,
and...
You know, time of year, it's really what people want to do. Do you enjoy, do you hate fishing out of the boat? Would you rather do all wade fishing? You know, the springtime, hey, you can't knock it. It's always busy. It's typically always good fishing. You know, it's a beautiful time to be there. The fall is another time, you know, that's busy. It's wading. You know, it's a beautiful time to be there. In the wintertime, it's nice and quiet, but the fishing can be good too, but it's cold. So,
yeah,
know.
It's an interesting, for people that haven't been there, it's very interesting because when we were there putting into the river in March, and then most of our trip was in April, most of the time there was snow on the upper rim of the Grand Canyon up at the 5,000-foot level. And but down in the canyon, it was shorts and T-shirt weather. So
yeah.
it's very interesting because you are very deep in the canyon and it holds the heat there around the rocks and the difference in altitude. From the top
sure.
to the bottom, too. So I thought that was very interesting.
It also holds the cold in the wintertime. You know, we're high desert. And so,
yeah.
you know, we are clear and cold in the winter. And we have a couple of spots upriver. We have one spot at 8 Mile that we call the icebox. And it's because it gets cold and it doesn't see the sun for like 5 months.
Oh,
and
wow.
it's because the sun is so far south.
Right.
And because
right.
of those canyon walls, it limits what kind of sunlight we get inside of that canyon, you know, in the wintertime. So, you know, that's something to be aware of. I mean, it can be really peaceful and not real busy and good fishing, but, I mean, you've got to layer up for it. But, you know, heated jet boats, I mean, when I first moved there, we ran ski barges open and bundled up in you know, snow in masks and, you know, covered your face. And, I mean, it was cold running upriver. And now, you know, you go up and it's 10 degrees outside with a wind chill of minus something in the boat, and it's 68 inside the cabin. So,
oh, wow.
You know,
wow.
It's a whole different game now.
That's nice. That's nice. Well, let's talk a little bit about equipment, flies, presentation. What does a person need to bring there as far as equipment? What would you recommend?
Well, you know, waders for sure. And, of course, we're all into the breathables. You know, you just layer up underneath of them. You can wear them any time of year. They're just much more comfortable. And if you're there in the summertime, you know, street shoes and stuff to fish out of the boat. As far as rods and reels, you know, a 9-foot rod is ideal. If you can fish a 9.5, if you have a longer one, you can do it. Not typically the spey rods. They're a little bit too long for what we do, but like a 9.5 or a 10-foot rod. Weight forward floating lines. We don't use any sink tips or anything. The floating lines need to be of neutral color. Our river is gin clear, and if you cast one of those fluorescent orange lines or a really bright yellow line, it's like the parting of the seas. We can stand up behind you and watch, and the fish will move from, you know, 5 feet away from that thing. They just run from the fly line. So neutral colored fly lines are important. Green, you know, something that occurs in nature. So that's important. You know, 9-foot, we typically use 9-foot leaders. 9-foot 5X is our standard call, except for in the summer when we're turning over big dries, we'll go with something a little heavier. We like 6 and 7X tippet material. Fluorocarbon, if you have it, works great. You know, you need split shot and indicators. The way we fish our river is we fish, we can do some midging in the back eddies and stuff like that, specifically throwing little tiny dries and stuff, longer leader, 7X tippet. Or if we're nymphing, we can nymph like a large attractor dry, a stimulator, humpy, big royal wolf, something like that, or a big cicada-type pattern, and then drop a beadhead zebra midge off of that anywhere from 2 to 5 feet and drift that. Or we'll use a strike indicator with split shot and two flies. And the trick is with our river is it's big. Like right now we're running up to, 17,000 CFS. And it's starting out at like 11, you know. So, you know, the river's large. And what we like to do is we like to pick it apart and make it like a grid. You'll make a shorter cast, you know, big mend in the line, and then introducing slack, so that you're making that indicator or that dry float totally natural with the current. And then you're watching that dry or that indicator to hesitate, pull sideways, or go under. And we want all the line off your reel. I mean, we're extending drifts as long as you can extend them to make that. Because it's such a big water, we want to cover as much water as we can. And so it's a different type of fishing, with that real long, you know, really super long, you know, drift. But it's it works very well. And then typically for people that fish it on their own and in the walk weight area too, is when they do this and if they hook a fish, I tell, don't move. Our river is not a river that holds a fish here and a fish there. If you catch a fish in an area, typically there's numerous fish in that general vicinity. It's just a matter of doing different drifts. And if you don't get a good drift in a spot where as that indicator floats totally natural, like, because every time you shake slack, if you're moving that indicator, you're lifting your flies off the bottom. And so it's not natural. So if you're not getting a good drift, do it again. Because the fish here at our, you know, on our water, they want a totally natural drift. And I have people that say they don't want to fish an indicator. But the fish take so subtle and spit so fast that if you don't have that indicator, you know, somebody who does have an indicator is going to catch 20 fish to your one. It's just the way the river is.
When you're doing these drifts, what kind of depth are you fishing normally?
We can fish water. I mean, the fish here will hold, you know, in water 6 inches up to, you know, 6 feet. It all depends. And you know, that's... The riffle, you know, it's riffles and runs, and you know, like I very rarely you're going to see me wading above my knees much, you know, and just running very long drifts. It just depends. Sometimes you're sight casting to fish in, you know, 6 to 12 inches of water, and then other times you're fishing off of a shelf that is about in a foot and a half to 2 feet of water that drops down into five. So it's just,
now,
you know.
Are you using your indicator? Well, obviously you're using it as an indicator, but are you also using it as a suspension device?
No. Only if you're fishing in very shallow water, where you're moving your indicator down closer to your flies. But a lot of times in that shallow water, we're just fishing a dry and a dropper instead.
Okay, take the indicator off.
Water.
Then.
Yeah. And one of the things I got to do not long ago. Terry and I were actually playing for a day in upriver, and we were sight casting to fish behind 4 mile. And it was so fun because I fished a single midge with a split shot, no indicator, anything, and you had to know where your fly landed, and then you had to watch for the reaction of the fish. For him to turn to eat, open its mouth, and it was so fun. It was so technical. It was very hard, but, you know, so typically we use the indicators and stuff, and it can be very, very successful on the river, but, you know, you need to have a good drift, and you need to catch, you know, if you're blind casting out where the fish are holding in the moss, where the scuds and stuff, you get moss once in a while on your flies, but not hanging up all the time. And, you know, it's just working on getting those good drifts. And, you know, that requires a cast more upstream, you know, a good punch of your rod sideways so that you put a good mend in it, and then throwing slack, introducing slack out there before it tightens up.
Time to take another break, and then we'll come back. Let's talk about some of the food sources there and some of the flies that you're using and get into that a little bit deeper, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization that uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties, again that's T-Y-E-S.com, familyties.com, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. So check it out. I'm sure you'll... You'd be amazed at what they're accomplishing. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Wendy Gunn about fly fishing the Colorado River at Lee's Ferry. If you'd like to ask Wendy a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's talk about, you had mentioned before, primary food sources were scuds, midges, and worms, other than the terrestrials that we've talked about. So there are no other hatches, no mayfly hatches or caddis hatches?
No hatches, no.
Other than midge hatches, right?
Midges, yep.
Yep. And are there any particular patterns that have been developed for that area that work better for you than others?
Well, you know, there are some flies that are specific to our area. You know, one of the first flies that was developed for fishing our river, and it was, you know, made where we are, was the deer hair back scud. Len Holt did it, you know, and so we use that in multiple colors. The beadhead zebra midge was developed at Lee's Ferry. it started out as a plain zebra, and the kid that worked for me, Ted Welling, took it home and took the thorax off of it and threw a silver bead on it and came back and said, try this. And so we use beadhead zebras in assorted colors and sizes, combinations, you know, black and silver, black and copper, and you know, what a phenomenal fly that's turned out to be all over. So, and then...
Yeah, we did have a comment there from Brian Wagner in Aztec who asked a previous question. At that walk-in above Priya Junction, he did well with zebra midges there, so...
Yeah. Well, see, like the attractor dry, when we fish the attractor dry on the surface, typically what we drop off of that is a beadhead zebra midge.
Okay.
We'll fish, and, you know, scuds, the deer-haired back scud with a zebra midge behind it.
What's
we'll
the thing with the deer hair on the back of the scud?
You know, Len Holt developed it, and it's just always, it's our number one scud pattern, and it is, we tie them in anywhere from 18s up to size 10, and we use, it's an Antron Sparkle Blend dubbing, and it's bright, and the main color that we use, three different colors, the main color is Ginger Variant. We use one that's called Crawdad Orange, and the other one is called a Shrimp Pink. And we use a dyed gray deer hair, and you know, stack it, put your tip ends off of the bend part of the hook, and that's your tail. And you tie that off, and we use wire and tie that off, then do your dubbing underneath. And you pull your deer hair down over the back, and that cases your back. That gives you your shell, your shell back, except for it's in deer hair. And then we rib it with the wire, you know, and then, of course, pick it out really good underneath. But that is our number one scud pattern. And the ginger variant has been the ticket the last, I don't know how many years. But that and the zebra midge and then San Juan worms, you know, we like them in size 12 or 16 or an 18, straight shank hook, you know, in assorted brown colors, sometimes a burnt orange, sometimes a red, you know, you never know. And then we do
You mentioned straight shank. You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, you know, on a straight shank hook, I typically like, you know, and I like a 3761 Tiemco barbless. And instead of, a lot of times they use, I can't even remember what they think of the name of it, it's a curved shank hook. And we found with that hook that we were having problems with on the larger size San Juan worms of that fly, actually the hook coming up and then getting it to come through up by the eye of the trout. So we quit using those hooks. And we just went to a straight shank, low profile hook, and it works great. We haven't had any problems with it at all. We do use some egg patterns, some glow bug patterns. Those typically, you know, when we're sight casting to fish that are spawning, you get the little guys that are hanging in behind him getting the escapement, you know, the row that doesn't stay where it's supposed to, and we'll use those. Another fly that was developed at Lee's Ferry is called an Unbelievable, and an Unbelievable is a floating dead scud imitation. And it's called an Unbelievable because when you see it, it's unbelievable that a fish would eat it. It's orange poly yarn tied onto a hook and wrapped, and it actually it's floating. It's a dry fly. And you have to have the right conditions in order to fish it. And when it happens, it's a ball. But typically what you have to have is you have to have lower water conditions where the water has dropped and it has stranded some scuds. up on the bank, up, you know, and expose them into warmer temperatures to where the scuds, just like a shrimp, it gets cooked. And they turn kind of orange. And then you get a rising water situation where the water comes up and it washes those dead scuds off of the gravel bars. And the scuds are floating on the surface. And the fish will eat them. And that's when the unbelievable comes into play. You're fishing actually a floating dead scud imitation on the surface.
Dry fly and fishing, huh?
Exactly. It is. It is exactly dry fly fishing. So, and one of our clients named it the unbelievable because, as he said, it was unbelievable that it caught fish.
Yeah. Well, strike indicators could catch fish if we ever got smart and put a hook in them half the time.
Yeah, well, you know, that's why we fish the dry dropper, because that's
exactly
what you're doing.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Well, we've had a couple questions in here. One from Joe Siviglia and Jim Thorpe in Pennsylvania. Wanting to know, are streamers needed, or can you catch large fish sipping flies on the surface? And then one came in over the internet while we're talking here from Brian Tracy in Santa Fe, and he says, is there any streamer fishing where you usually wade? And how big do the fish usually get? So tell us about streamer fishing.
Sure. We don't typically do a lot of streamer fishing at Lee's Ferry. It's primarily nymph fishing with the scuds and the midges. You will get, you know, some of the dry fly fishing, like I said, but most of the bigger fish we get nymph fishing. You can do some streamer fishing. I've done some, especially in the higher water situations. I'll throw like a T200 on a 6-weight and do some woolly bugger fishing, and it can be successful. Does it necessarily catch bigger fish? No, it doesn't. If you know, the best thing to do is, you know, at Lee's Ferry, our average fish right now is falling right in that 16 to 18-inch range. Fat, healthy, they got shoulders on them, they look great, the fishery is very healthy right now. You know, we do see some bigger fish and we do see some smaller fish, no doubt, but, you know, the best thing for bigger fish is just to go looking for them. It's if you don't care about numbers, you know, and you got a guide and you just say, you know, you want to go looking for the bigger boys, and typically they're laying in the riffles also, you know, feeding on the midges and the scuds and stuff. So, you can do the streamer fishing. It can be very productive, but it doesn't necessarily catch bigger fish.
Is there any certain time of day that's better or worse on the river, you know, for a good bite?
You know, a lot of times on the rising water, when we have the water rising for power demand, we'll tend to turn things loose. Sometimes that can get the fish eating better as the water comes up. Sometimes it'll kick some scuds loose, things like that, which will actually get the fish feeding more. You know, a lot of times, you know, it depends, because I've been out there, some days it's better in the morning, some days it's better in the afternoon. So not necessarily. The one thing that can be better is when it's rising, but like the cicada fishing and stuff, it tends to be better if it was cloudy, you know, and just not sunny, and the clouds came in the afternoon. So, you know, it just depends.
Is there, because we were talking about this on our last show, I had noticed over on the San Juan River that the fish didn't start moving until later in the morning, and they talk about that on the Arkansas River in Colorado. And that's due to basically the hatches, you know, getting going.
Yeah, you're waiting for the water to warm. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. So you don't have that issue here with the midges, or, I mean, I got putting that out there as a question, I guess.
Sometimes it takes the sun, you know, to get the midges to come off, or it'll take cloud cover to get them. I mean, we typically, it really doesn't play as far as time of day. I mean, we don't have to be out there at the crack of dawn. There's, you know, no reason. Typically, we're starting at, depending on the time of year, anywhere from 6 to 7:30 in the morning. And that all goes by when we're seeing the better fishing. But we don't have to time it for hatches or anything like that. Like I said, you know, sometimes the fishing's better in the afternoon, sometimes it's better in the mornings, and it depends on the time of year that you're there, I would say, more than anything else. Because, like, when we're cicada fishing, we want to go a little later because it typically tends to be better later. You know, it really just depends on the time of year.
Okay, okay. Anything else you'd like to tell us about fishing the river, you know, particular techniques, specific things that other than you've mentioned already?
Yeah, you know, it's primarily the Lee's, like I said, you know, I think the lure of Lee's Ferry is that it's ever-changing. You know, you can fish it in the summer, it's going to be different. You can come in the fall, it's going to be different. You can come in the spring, it's going to be different. You know, different types of fishing. But I think more than anything else that Lee's Ferry is special is in the extended drift fishing, is in that real, you know, shaking out that line and getting that good dead drift. I think it's very unique. And once you get that fishing down on the river, you can use it on virtually almost any moving water and, you know, find that you can increase your productivity anywhere because you can cover so much more water. And that's what it's all about, is covering water. You know, getting that fly in front of as many fish as you can.
Exactly, yeah. I noticed that, again, it happened to be on the San Juan, but there was a section there that when you floated it in a drift boat, it was this long, deep run and then a big flat out from the run. And when you drifted it, it was real easy to get that long, deep drift through there, and you'd pick up great fish off the bottom there. But then when we went and tried to... Pardon?
That was Texas Hole.
No, not Texas Hole. No, this
was
downriver. Yeah.
Okay.
No, but it was a long run along against a bank. But if you tried to fish it from the bank side or from the flat side on the other side, it was really hard to get that deep drift that you're talking about because it just took too long to get down before, you know, you could scrape the bottom with it and then be coming up again. So I know what you're saying, and it is require a lot of technique to be able to do that, and I could see the application there.
Yeah,
it is,
and like I said, for here, you know, when we get the higher water and stuff like that where the fish are out there deeper, that's when we use the boats because it allows people to get out to those fish, and it's virtually very difficult in some water situations to do it from shore.
Right. Now, when you go up in the morning for a day's fishing, do you run all the way up, or do you? I guess I'm asking too. How much water do you cover in a day? Would it be a few miles, 5 miles? Do you kind of hang out in an area?
Yeah. Well, you know, it all depends. It depends on the time. You know, the time of year water flows. You know, as far as where you're going to go, how many boats are in front of you? You know, like in the springtime and stuff like that, you're counting boat trailers. You want to know how many boats are up in front of you, and then you pay attention to boats where they're at on the river so that you know who's up ahead of you and where they are. So you pick your spots that way. You watch other boat traffic to see when people are moving. You know, you might have noticed that Kevin or Skip was at, you know, 14 mile, and then all of a sudden they come down river and you are someplace else, so you know that spot opened up, so maybe you're going to go up there. You know, and when it's really busy, like it can be, especially in the spring, you might get into a spot and, hey, fishing's good. You're not going to move. You're going to stay there all day.
Yeah.
So, or you could be with somebody who's only there for one day or a single angler. I mean, if you have a single angler on the boat, you can pop into so many places. You know, you can move all over the place or, you know, maybe they want to see the dam. So you got to make sure you go up and show them the dam. You know, that's what guides do. I mean, that's what they get paid to do. They do their best job they can trying to get you into the best situations, and that's what you do. Is you have to, on our river, you got to play all of that, you know, where boats are, you know, water flows and everything else.
Little tip for folks, if you go park your boat trailer in that lot, it is on a slope. when we were there rigging our rafts, all of a sudden we heard this big, loud, crunching noise. And we look up, and somebody's truck with the boat trailer, it was pointed uphill with the boat trailer downhill from it, and evidently they didn't set their emergency brake. And that truck started backing down the hill by itself. Nobody was around. They were already on the water. And the thing jackknifed, bent the trailer in half, and went into a big dumpster.
Yeah.
I got a picture of it. It was pretty nasty. When that person came back that day, he did not have a good day. Let's put it that way.
No.
Yeah.
It can happen. Yeah. That's that one area where they can park,
Yeah, it's on a slope. So make sure you set your brake there, folks. Well, let's talk about if a person were to take a trip there. You already mentioned that you've got all their bases covered there with the lodge, the restaurants, the fly shop, the guide service. Are there other, is there like camping around there, grocery stores? I know you said it's a ways to Page, but
Sure. Well, there's a Park Service campground located down by Lee's Ferry. It's on a first-come, first-served basis. I've been there 20-some years. I've only seen it full once or twice, so that's usually not an issue. It's $10 a night. There are restrooms. There are no hookups. So there is the campground there. As far as convenience items for a store, there is a small convenience store. It does not carry a lot, you know, a little bit of basics, milk and some eggs, maybe some bread and some lunch meat, and that's about it, not a lot. And as I tell everybody, if you're going to buy milk, make sure you check the date. you know, it is out in the middle of nowhere, so, you know, there is those convenience items there. So, you know, there's a few things around the area, but, you know, for major groceries or anything, yeah, they'd have to go up into Page. But, and then there's campsites upriver also. There are there's specific areas that you can camp up there. Those are first come, first serve also. You have to have a boat, though, in order to camp in those areas because you have to be able to get up there yourself. And, you know, if we rent boats also, power
boats.
Oh,
you boats. Do? Okay.
Yes, we do. It's not recommended if you haven't been up there. To just take a boat and go, because there is riffles, runs, islands, submerged trees, rocks, you know, there are hazards. And, you know, it's nice to at least have some kind of an idea of what you're getting yourself into to go out there. So, you know, it's recommended that you get a guide, at least your first time up there, if not more than that.
Right.
You know, so that you can, because 15 and a half miles of river is a lot of river.
Yeah,
and I mean, we can sell you a map and tell you where to go, but there's nothing upriver that says you're at 3 mile or, you know, you're at 4 mile or, you know, anything like that. So,
right.
You know, it is wise to have a guide up there, you know, to get you around and show you the day. I mean, you know, that's what they're there for, but there is camping up there also.
And you had said earlier, you had suggested a minimum, you didn't say minimum, but I took it that way, of 3 days to spend on
the
river.
Yeah, well, you know, 2 days, I think, is minimum that you should fish any water, because that's the that's rule anywhere you go. It should have been
right.
Here yesterday or come back tomorrow. You know, always, because fishing can be off one day, and the next day can be totally different. You know, optimum time, I think, is 3 days on the river, because you get to see lots of different aspects. You know, if you can come for more, that's great. But, you know, 3 days, I think, is a good amount of time to see that 15 and a half miles and see what all it can offer.
Yeah. Well, let's take a few minutes and just talk about women in fly fishing, if you don't mind. Could you describe, one of the questions, could you describe the opportunities for women in fly fishing today?
Well, you know, I think there's lots of opportunities for women in fly fishing. You know, there's more and more women getting into it all the time. There's more and more women's clubs. There's more, one thing that I've noticed doing slideshows and stuff for clubs in Arizona is there's more couples where, you know, you're actually finding the women, more families for that matter, more kids and the whole gamut for getting going. I think, you know, there's more female guides around. You know, so if it makes you more comfortable to be around women to learn, you know, the great thing is about fly fishing for women is, you know, it's not a blood sport. It's not a power sport. It's timing. It's finesse. It's artistic. I mean, it's just, and fish do not live in ugly places. They
right.
just don't. You know, so it's a great excuse to get out there and go see things and get into new places, and like I said, you know, whether, you know, your significant other, your children, or your husband, I mean, you know, you can do some great things together that involve fly fishing.
Well, if you have if a woman wanted to get, you know, like you, maybe saw somebody doing this and thought it was, you know, just incredibly beautiful and so forth, like we all have done at one point in our lives, and yet maybe they're single or their spouse is not fishing. How would you suggest they get started?
Go to a fly shop, local fly shop. Find a fly shop. That's one of the best places to get going. And then ask. You know, there's a lot of women that work in fly shops. I know there's a lot of women that run fly shops. Ask them about clubs, because they would have information on all the different fly fishing clubs. Typically, most metropolitan areas have numerous clubs. For different areas. You know, go in and then maybe go to a club meeting, you know, and you would meet people. You would, and like I said, there's more and more women at these all the time. And then they offer, typically they offer classes for little or no charge, of casting, you know, tying, whatever. And then they also do outings. You know, it's a great way to get to see, you know, some different stuff, you know, and get involved in it without, you know, it's just, and the thing about fly fishermen, all of us, we share knowledge. I mean, we're not, I'm catching fish and you're not, you know, we typically, we're all willing to try to help people. And that's one of the great things about the sport. So if they can go into one of the shops and then maybe go see a club, you know, they can find out a lot of stuff. And there's women's clubs and all sorts of things to get involved with.
Yeah, there, and I think clubs are great because you've got people that are willing to volunteer there to help you. And if on our website, folks, if you go to the bottom of any of the pages, you'll see a link to clubs, and then you can drill down by state or province, country, and find a club. And the clubs that are women, primarily women only, are designated in there too, so you can see that if that's where you'd like to go. But even if it's not, most of the clubs have people that are just ready, willing, and able to help. So it's always nice and always warm and fuzzy when you go there. So
they are. They're great. Way. They're like large extended families.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, let's end with this one question from Brian in Clemson, South Carolina. And he said, what would be the best approach to get my wife genuinely interested in the sport? I've enjoyed fly fishing for 17 years because I love to catch fish, but also because it provides endless learning opportunities, which you talked about earlier. I am not sure if she would approach the sport from the same direction as I do. What do you suggest?
Boy, you know, the thing is, does she show an interest? Because, you know, we've couples. I know a gal who fly fishes and her husband doesn't, and he doesn't want to. And I have had guys who try to get their girls, and they really could care less. So does she, you know, and so you can't force it. Does she have a genuine interest in it? If she does, then go hire a guide somewhere, maybe a female guide, and, you know, have them concentrate with her and, you know, and see if she really, you know, work with her on her casting and everything and go from there. But take her to a beautiful place. You know, where the surroundings entice you and the guides are great and maybe they have a good restaurant and, you know, wine and diner a little bit and make it, you know, more about not just the fishing, but about everything else that comes along with it. But she has to have a genuine interest. And if she doesn't, I don't think you can force that.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
there's some that just, I mean, Terry had a gal the other day, the guy hired, you know, he really wanted her, and she looked at her, and Terry says, you know, what do you really want to do today? And she says, you know, I really just want to sit here and watch and read my book. And he goes, okay, that's what you'll do. You know, because she really didn't have the interest in it. So,
well, that's,
you know.
That's exactly the way my wife and I approach things. She's never really had an interest in fishing, but she'll take a lawn chair and a book and just go out and sit and watch me.
Exactly.
And she's perfectly happy with that.
Uh-huh. And, I mean, it's like I said, fish live in beautiful places, so it's a
exactly.
great excuse to go and just hang out.
Yeah, just sit under the sun and enjoy the view, yeah. Well, yeah. Great. Well, we've had a great show. Unfortunately, we've got to wrap things up here. Things will move kind of quick here, but stick with me, Wendy, for a few more minutes. When we get back, we're going to be giving away a 3-year membership with the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So stay tuned to see if you win. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org or www.ifishon.org or call 866-237-5725. 866-237-5725. Well, from our global events calendar, we see that the 22nd annual Jackson Hole One Fly event will be held on September 6th through 9th, and the actual competition will take place on September 8th and 9th. The proceeds from this event are awarded as matching grants to projects benefiting conservation education, trout habit protection and restoration, and natural resource management specific to the native cutthroat fishery in the Snake River watershed and its tributaries. Go to the Global Events calendar on our website. The link is near the bottom of every page, and look under the U.S., then Wyoming, for more information. You'll get a link to their site there. Now, just a reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, just take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, "What did you think of the show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And the winners are drawn randomly from our database. So if you haven't registered for tonight's show, it's too late now, but be sure you do it for the next show, because we're always giving away some great, great gifts and prizes. Now, if you're the lucky winner tonight, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So I've got this magic button here, Wendy, on my computer screen, and when I click it, it goes out and searches for the winner. So I'm going to let you tell me when to click it, and we'll see what we get.
All right. Click it.
Okay, we've got, well, close to you, Van Reese in Utah. Van Reese in Utah. Congratulations, Van. The 3-year membership to the Federation, which is always a great membership to have.
Yep, that's a great thing.
Yeah, and now we have another one, the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, which is a great magazine coming out of Calgary, Canada. Very good magazine to learn techniques from. So the next winner, go ahead, Wendy, say when.
Click it.
And we've got Rad Brashears in Texas. Rod Brashears in Texas, I'm sorry. So, Rod, again, both Van and Rod, congratulations on winning tonight, and enjoy your gifts. So, Wendy, we really appreciate you being with us tonight, and thanks for taking your time to share your experiences and your knowledge with us about fly fishing the Colorado River at Lee's Ferry. Hopefully you can come join us again.
Oh, I'd love to come anytime.
Yeah, talk about one of your other adventures away from home, maybe. Huh? So, sounds like you've got a lot of them going on. So.
Well, hopefully if we do another show by then, I'll have some more even to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we all would like that. Well, our next broadcast will be on August 15th at 7 p.m. Mountain and 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll be interviewing Michael Mullaney. And our topic for the show will be Stripping for Stripers. And the East Coast comes alive when the stripers come in, making the water boil and with activity. And Michael Mahaney, a professional guide in Cape Cod, is going to share his secrets on catching one of the most popular sport fish on the eastern seaboard. Well, we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Platte River Fly Shop, Women in Fly Fishing, Family Ties, and Reeling and Healing Midwest for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And feel free to explore the other areas of our website, like the events calendar and the directories. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.